under a communist moon, international noise conspiracy. That's right, and it should stop people to howling. In fact, I know a very special friend of mine, a large Rottweiler, is probably howling. He howls every time he hears that song because he wants to live under a communist moon, as do I. Anyway, I'm Michael Slade. It's KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. On the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Sareem Makdisi. He's a professor at UCLA, a professor of English literature at UCLA, and the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And we're going to be talking about the nature of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and the invasion and massacre in Gaza that began on the 27th of December. Before that, we'll be having a brief visit with Deborah Sweet, the national director of The World Can't Wait, on what World Can't Wait has been doing in D.C., during the inauguration, the kinds of demonstrations they've been having there, actions they've been having there. And before that, opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back, although he's walking on eggshells and I want him to know that, I'm very pleased to welcome back Larry Everest, reporter for Revolution Newspaper, author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Rocking the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're going to be talking today about the Obama inauguration and Obama. Actually, not just about the inauguration, but Obama. And what can people expect from this? What should we expect? What should we start to open up our eyes about? And I think this is, and for all of you who have been Obamnified and Obaminated and Obamnatized and all of this, when you get out of detox, you'll thank me for this program, okay? But I do want to say that I think it's actually, seriously, people should listen. If you are a big Obama supporter and you think he's actually going to be making great change and bringing the world to a different place, a good place, listen to the show, write to us, let us know what you think about it. But listen to the show, listen to what we have to say. I think it's extremely important that we dig into this and we not just roll over and, you know, run after what's going on. So, Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, a communist moon. Change,
that's right.
I can believe him.
There you go. You got it, man. You got it. Very good. Now, you see, you got off of the eggshells and you're right back in the heart of things, man.
Or I broke them, whichever. Whatever I did.
Well, listen, man, you know, we talked about this yesterday and a little bit today, and you know, part of the thing that has really, you know, if you watch what's been going on, there has been just a huge, huge, huge outpouring around Obama. I mean, I think it's very difficult. I think, and you know, I was listening the other day on the radio to the concert, the We Are One concert that was broadcasting. Every major cultural figure in the country, I think, actually was involved in that and was in one way or another throwing their lot in with this hope they have around Obama and what is Obama going to do. And you know, you can understand some of this in relation to, you know, what we're coming out of, the period that we're coming out of, which was a horror for the world. But also then you're looking at this thing and people do look at it as, you know, it's the first black president, and he talks about change, and people are really looking for something. But there seems to be, really, people have turned off a lot of their critical thinking. They've turned off a lot of their even just listening to what the man is saying and analyzing it. So I wanted to get your hit, and it hit me again today at listening to his inaugural speech. And I wanted to get your hit on that because I think, again, people needed to have listened to what he said. And what was your hit on his speech?
Well, I think you're, first of all, I totally agree. People need to listen to the speech. And I also, you know, your point, I mean, look what's going on. 8 years of Bush, which is actually part of what created the deep, deep desire for real change, not Obama himself. He didn't create that in the main. It was the 8 years of Bush and all the vexing and wrenching contradictions that are going on in the world. And it was interesting because Obama just started right out speaking to that. I mean, he spoke directly to the crisis that the rulers of this country are facing. And, you know, he talked about, this isn't the still waters of peace. This is a time of gathering clouds and raging storms. We're in the midst of a crisis. We're at war. The economy is weakened. And then he said something interesting. No less profound is a sapping of confidence, a nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable. In other words, that the system is in trouble, and this is giving rise to profound questioning. But then his message was essentially, look, the system is not the problem. He said, the way we get out of this is returning to the documents and the founding principles of America. In other words, capitalist and the dictatorship of the capitalist class, and we could add the foundational oppression of African Americans, which has not changed. And then he even made a specific point that the problem isn't capitalism. It's, you know, he said directly that it's not whether the market's a force for good or evil, it's power to generate wealth and expand freedom is unmatched, Obama said. So it's just a matter of regulating it better. So his approach to what is a systemic crisis and very revealing of the bankruptcy and horror of capitalism and imperialism is to defend that system. And then he goes on and argues very stridently or strongly that the people need to sacrifice and defend this system and take responsibility. The new era of responsibility. Every American has a duty to the nation. Well, you know, what does that mean? Signing up to fight in Afghanistan, taking a pay cut so the capitalist system can survive and to create new horrors. And so I think that was very striking to me, and I think it's something you and I have talked about, we've analyzed in Revolution newspaper, that the very reason Obama was selected was the rulers of this country feel that their system is at a very perilous moment, and they need a new face on this empire, and they need someone who can enlist the population, someone who isn't so hated as Bush and Cheney were. And here we saw Cheney being led out in a wheelchair today. You know, I'm sure that was, interesting.
Fishing for sympathy.
He's
about to go on the lam. That's what's happening.
Let me ask you this, Larry,
because, see, there's a point. I mean, I think that this point that you're getting at is extremely important. But I think there's, people will say to you, And they have. I mean, you think about when you're talking about this thing of what Andrew Sullivan said at that, way back about, the Obama's face being the best thing to present to the world. And then this thing of the culture wars, and that this is actually this, what better way to resolve this war between the dead past and the people from the 60s and the older generations and this whole thing that was opened up in the 60s, let's close that back together. And that, frankly, that is what really got me sick listening to that concert on Sunday. I mean, that was just, to me, all this stuff. I mean, here's the flags all over the place, the Marines singing the national anthem, and there's and all this stuff, and then Springsteen out there, and all these other people, and they were playing, I almost puked when they played A Change Is Gonna Come, Change Is Gonna Come, and I thought, oh, this is just too much. And then I realized they were beaming that out all over the world, and there is something that they're doing with this in terms of, like you're saying, the whole thing is remake America, save the system. And to the world, what does that mean? What is the picture that they're presenting to the world? That everything America is going to do is going to be good and in the interests of what,
Well, I know. I mean, when I saw the getting over the culture war thing, the first thing I thought was, what was wrong with the culture war? The culture war was a war against racism, sexism, chauvinism, America, right or wrong. You and I came of age in that period, and thankfully we did. And the problem with the culture war is it didn't go far enough. But I also think that what you're pointing to is the fact that, Obama is, it's not a question that Obama simply isn't going to do everything that the so-called progressive or enlightened people want him to do. The point is he's doing actual harm by convincing people to get behind an empire and serve the empire. I mean, look, in terms of what the United States is doing around the world and what this really means, two examples that I sort of jumped out at me were Gaza and Oscar Grant. Oscar Grant, the young black man who was shot in the back here in Oakland. And so what do we see in the new year, this horrible massacre against Palestinians that was directed and armed by the United States in Gaza, and we see the murder of Oscar Grant. And this shows us that these deep contradictions and the horrific crimes of the system aren't being mitigated because Obama is the next president. They're actually sharpening up because of the very workings of the system. And meanwhile, what's Obama's response to both? Silence, going along, refusing to criticize either thing, which tells us right now that he's not at all about radical change, but what he is about, as you're pointing to with this concert, is about really trying to line people up, trying to make them, quote, feel good about America again.
Well, let me ask you this, because see, many people, and I think, you know, look, this is a very heavy, you know, I talked to people who were out at the Martin Luther King Day parade here yesterday, and they were taking out the I guess one of the posters, they were taking out this, the issue of Revolution newspaper on the black national question, the oppression of black people. And they were also taking out the current issue of the paper, which had this thing about, you know, has a lot of articles that speak to the situation around Obama, including the back page, which says, Uncle Bam wants you, you know, don't do it. Just saying, basically, don't do it, you know, don't go. And, people had a, you know, the response that a lot of people had, it was a very tense situation because people actually, they have so much vested in this, and people will say to you, look, Obama is going, and we've had this from many, many different quarters. Obama is, he's had the lie. You know, it was actually Jonah Goldberg had a reactionary writer, if there ever was one, had a column in the paper the other day that said, you know, it was basically mocking people for their sort of the veil down over their eyes and refusing to see what Obama's saying. And also, for accepting this, the explanation that he's lying, you know, whenever, whether it's around Rick Warren, whether it's around, you know, what he has to say around the war or anything else. But people will say Obama intends, and this is the bottom line argument. He intends to do good. He intends to make change. And it's up to us to have his back in order to make him be able to do that change.
Well, the problem with that, and here's our, quote, teachable moment, unquote. What's possible and not possible doesn't have anything to do really with either human nature, with personal responsibility, with whatever Barack Obama does or does not want to do. Even if these people who feel that they're mind readers, despite what everything Obama has stated and everything he's ever done, but they're mind readers and they think he's a real radical, it really doesn't matter, because what gets done and what's possible and not possible is dictated by a system, and that system has three rules. Nothing happens unless somebody makes a profit. Individual capitalists are in a expand or die battle with each other, survival of the fittest, and that anything that gets in the way of America being the world's most powerful empire has to be brought to heel or crushed. This is how things actually work. And this is what's going to dictate the choices. And people have to look beneath the surface, you know, your show, and see that that's going on. And then, here's an example.
But, you know, wait. People will say to you, what people will say is, yes, but, you know, he can buck it. He can actually buck the system. He can actually, and if we have his back, he can actually go up against those rules that you've laid out.
But see, the problem is this. The system won't work. It will fall apart. It will go, unless we replace it, unless there's a revolutionary replacement and a whole different system, that system will simply cease to function. And there would, if there would be chaos and dysfunctioning. And the other thing that would happen is he would be removed by the ruling class, and they know how to remove people, impeachment, indictment, and so on and so forth, who are acting against the interests of their system. And this has been shown repeatedly, even where there's simply disagreements over tactics, let alone fundamental.
Let me ask you this, because we have about 4 minutes, and I want to make sure that we're actually able to talk about an example. The big thing, many, many people got behind Obama thinking he will get us out of war, his foreign policy. How does what you're saying actually, how does that hold up against, measure up against what he's doing with his foreign policy?
Well, today in his speech, he said our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Now, that's simply, he's repeating Bush war on terror. And he warns, you cannot outlast us. We will defeat you. So he's carrying on this war on terror, war for greater empire, which, as you and I have talked about, the imperialists consider essential to maintaining global power. At the same time, he does have strategic and differences with Bush over how to carry it out. He told the Washington Post a couple of days ago that, you know, his problem was Bush treated Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan as discrete, separate problems, but he would treat them as a unified whole and have a coherent approach, which he argued would be more effective. Well, what is so good about being a more effective global imperialist superpower? So the changes he's talking about are, A, within the framework of this same global empire, and he even said in his speech, America doesn't have to apologize for our way of life, which, you know, this way of life is based on extreme exploitation of hundreds of millions of people around the world in a situation in which a few rich countries control 85% of the wealth and the rest of humanity, billions of people, have what's left. So what he's doing is, yes, there's going to be adjustments, it seems, but within this framework. And we can look at who he's appointed to his cabinet. They're all people that have served the imperialist state, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, go on down the list.
I'm glad you brought that up, because the big problem here, though, is, you know, and a lot of what you see in terms of the criticisms of him is that he's bringing back all the Clintonites. Well, this is not going to be a return to the Clinton years.
No, right. I mean, look, the point here is that what's going to dictate what the U.S. rulers do fundamentally is the necessities they face. A lot of the shifts that Obama is even discussing were done 2 years ago under George Bush, at least to some degree. That's why you have Robert Gates, Bush's Secretary of Defense, being carried over into the Obama administration. In other words, it goes to the point that Bob Avakian has made a number of times. The decisions, elections are not how decisions get made. Decisions get made by the political political elite and political decision makers of the capitalist imperialist state based on their interests. And so there's been a consensus developing that there needed to be a change of approach from the first Bush term. And, you know, and that is what to some degree was implemented in the second Bush term, and Obama is indicating he will continue, and I'm sure he'll make his own adjustments, but it's within that framework. Another big theme he had was, look, we can't remain the world's number one power without alliances and without refurbishing our image as an enlightened democracy and the beacon to the world. So a lot of what he's doing is in service of better maintaining U.S. hegemony around the world. And for the last 60 or 70 years, we've seen what that's meant time and time again.
Okay, Larry, I want to ask you one question, and you have about 20 seconds to answer it, maybe 30. So when people say to you, yeah, but he's better than Bush, and that's got to be good, what would you say?
Not if he disarms people from fighting for, you know, for right, for stopping war crimes, and for fighting for an actual better future, a revolutionary future. He could end up being, in that way, he could be end up being worse than the others in this. This is what the real danger is right now, is that they want to be able to muddle through this by having a leader like Obama who can get people to, quote, give him a chance. But the question is, a chance to do what? He has no problem with the system. His goal is to save this system. And we had one FDR. That was one FDR too many. You know, this system is a nightmare and a whore, and we need something far better. The communist moon you were talking about, to return to where we started.
That's it, man. All right, Larry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, always fun, Michael.
And we'll have you back again
soon.
How
many eggshells did I break, though?
You got them all straight, man. It's all cool.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. And people want to read Larry's latest article on Gaza. They can get it at revcom.us. Larry, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again soon.
Take care, man. Bye-bye.
I'm Michael Slate, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We've just been talking with Larry Everest, writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Deborah Sweet, National Director of The World Can't Wait.
Looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind, so he was willing to make a deal. He came across this big guy plucking on the
bed. I gotta tell you, I just love go-go music, man. It's just, and I've stumbled onto a treasure trove of go-go music. Go-go, rarely, not that well known outside of DC, but an amazing, amazing music. Just incredible. That's Big Tony with The Devil Went Down to DC. Joining us now to talk about what's going on in D.C., and in particular the demonstrations that have been happening over the weekend, is Deborah Sweet, National Director of The World Can't Wait. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I have to apologize. I don't have much of a voice. We've been out among the people in the crowds for 3 days and mixing it up, talking a lot about what's going on. And it's also very cold, as you know, so I'll try to do my best here to project.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Why don't you tell people what you have been doing? I know the World Can't Wait had a couple of demonstrations scheduled for down there, right? Or a couple of activities that were going on?
Yeah, I'll run down what happened. We came into D.C. from around the country under the slogan, Stop the U.S. War of Terror and Torture. The World Can't Wait. And we also had a second slogan, Prosecute Bush War Crimes Now. And big banners to those effects and posters that people could carry around in the inaugural parade, including one that said, No Common Ground with bigot Rick Warren. And as people know, I'm very sorry, Rick Warren spoke at the inauguration today, which was very controversial.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, I was going to tell people that, you know, we had Sansara Taylor on the show last week, and one of the things that happened was that at Ebenezer Baptist Church down in Atlanta, Sansara actually stood up. Rick Warren was speaking, and Sansara stood up and basically ended up, denouncing Rick Warren as a bigot and saying no common ground for bigots with bigot Rick Warren. And she was holding a banner, and she was ushered out of the church, but it created quite a stir, and there were other people who were out there demonstrating too. But it was sort of, this is the kind of, you know, you think about Rick Warren is giving the, you know, this is for people who have been Obamnified. I think you got to give some serious thought to what does it mean that Rick Warren was out there doing this. Deborah, you know, when you were talking about the demonstration, the stuff around Rick Warren, there was other things that also, I wanted to try and hit, because we're going to have a limited amount of time, both for your voice, but also because of the schedule of the show. But I wanted to try and hit at this thing. You guys have actually, you also had a demonstration around Arrest Bush Now, right?
Yeah, we did a couple of things. We were with a group of people yesterday that gathered in DuPont Circle. It was called Shoe Bush. And of course, that is after the guy in Iraq, the reporter that threw his shoes at Bush in December, and is still in prison for that, al-Zairi. And the idea was to throw shoes at the White House on Bush's last day, which it had a beat to it, and hundreds of people came out yesterday. Probably 10,000 people threw shoes from a pile at a giant inflatable Bush. And then we had an unpermitted march, and not entirely impromptu, but an unpermitted march down to the White House. And we got close to a fence of the White House and in an area, you know, surrounded by police. Hundreds of people threw shoes at the White House. And it was moving to hear people say why they were throwing the shoes. We had vets of the Iraq and Afghanistan war, people who had lost their children. We had Iraqis and people from various countries, a lot of youth and other vets and older people, all, you know, by and large saying, I'm throwing these Jews for the people of the world. It was an extremely interesting and fun thing to do, and we ended up getting a lot of coverage for that.
Now,
that
one thing I was going to say is actually part of the, I mean, that sounds really good, and I'm really glad that happened. It was really absolutely necessary and called for, and very creative, actually. I wish I was there. But I also think, I think here's a question for you, because I think there's actually, you know, a lot of people are probably thinking, okay, well, you know, you're having, what's the connection? You're having this thing of arrest Bush now, and then you're at the inauguration, and there's sort of this change going over. What's behind that? What link do you see between Bush and Obama? What's the purpose of being at Obama's inauguration with the demand around arrest Bush now?
Well, of course, this is a demand that even made its way up into the ruling circles right now. Over the question of torture in particular, there's discussion over prosecution. And Eric Holder on Thursday, I think, in his confirmation hearings for Attorney General, said that he believes waterboarding is torture. Now, this is a difference from the last Attorney General, who said he couldn't really say whether it was or not, and from Dick Cheney, who says it's necessary, but it's not torture. There's a different thing going on, but we really wanted people not to be fooled. The demand to prosecute these people for war crimes is an utterly legitimate demand coming from around the world and from people living in this country. We need to take responsibility to see this through. Why? Not because we have a thing about Bush or Cheney, but all the things that they did to shape what this country has become and to take it in both a fascist direction and the direction of empire, to come up with and prosecute this war of terror on the people for empire.
You know,
that's got to be rebuked.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And one of the things that's actually really interesting is that, you know, I've read somewhere that on Obama's website, that one of the big things, one of the most popular demands, one of the most popular things they want to have Obama do is to go after Bush and Cheney for war crimes. You know,
yeah,
prosecute
exactly.
them.
In fact, I think it was number one for a while anyway on change.gov. And I have to report from being among these huge crowds that people carrying signs that simply say arrest Bush and our banners that said prosecute Bush for war crimes were probably photographed tens of thousands of times. Hmm. People were giving us donations just to have their picture taken with the banner,
for all those people who have been, you know, who again have been, you know, just like, really, I don't know what to call it, you know, the hypnotized by Obama or the Obama phenomenon, you know, to listen to, and I heard this on the radio, and I can't remember what I was listening to, but it was last week, and I remember it was early, I was just waking up, and I remember just jumping up going, did he just say that? The thing where Obama said, well, you know, we nobody's above the law when he's talking about torture and all this other stuff, and he says, but, you know, we're about looking forward, not looking backward, and we don't want to have the CIA take away from their important work and get all lawyered up and keep looking over their shoulders. What is the man saying?
He's saying, Michael, this is what I think he's saying. We're not going to call it torture, but the two issues to really look at is they're going to continue secret rendition, which after all was begun by the Democrats in 93. Mm-hmm. He's even brought the guy into his administration, John Brennan, who developed the secret rendition program. And the second thing is that they're not going to veer from the so-called enhanced interrogation methods. At least so far, they're not saying they're going to. Mm-hmm. And so they can continue torture either by third countries or by private contractors and by the book say we are not torturing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's utterly unacceptable. And to wade into these crowds, where people are cheering the idea of arrest Bush, and then to speak to people about, and even cheering our banner that said, stop the occupations and torture for empire. The world can't wait. And say, but wait a minute. You know, President Obama right now is 4 hours into being a war crimes president this afternoon. Mm-hmm. He is now responsible for these crimes. He's sending 30,000 more troops, a whole brigade to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And what do we know about the U.S. war in Afghanistan? Repeated mass bombings of civilians.
All right, Deborah, we're going
to... their very face.
We're going to have to wrap it up at the moment, so I will. I look forward to having you back again, though, and revisiting these issues.
All these reports and our speeches and videos are on worldcan'twait.org.
I was just going to explain that. Okay, thank you very much, Deborah. Talk to you soon, and drink some lemon something or other, lemon tea. All right, I'm Michael Slayton. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, eventually we will come back and we will talk with Sari Makdisi about the situation in Gaza today. But before that, when we come back from the break, we're going to be hearing a song that's called We Will Not Go Down Gaza. It's by a guy named Michael Hart. Now, some people who listen to Radio Intifada may have heard this the other day. I found it on the World Can't Wait site and then went to Michael's website, michaelhart.com, and it was just a very moving song, and I wanted to share that with all the listeners to this show. So we're not even going to take a break. We'll just go right to the song, and then we'll come back and we'll talk to Sari.
In Lakeview Terrace.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
Welcome back. That's Michael Hart, H-E-A-R-T. We will not go down Gaza. And I think it's michaelhart.com or .org. Try one of those. You can go and you can actually get the song for yourself. It's a beautiful song. Very heartfelt, very, very powerful. I'm very happy to welcome back to the show now someone who's been on at least once, maybe twice before, Sari Makdisi. And Sari is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA. He's also a much-published commentator and author around the Middle East, and in particular, questions of Palestine. And his book is Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. I believe it came out last spring, and it is, and if you want to know what it means to be in an, if you want to get a good grounding in the situation of the Palestinian people, you want to get a good grounding in what's going on with Palestine and what it means to be living under occupation, this book is a must. Okay, it's out, published by Norton. It's Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. Sari, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. There's an abysmal ignorance, almost an enforced ignorance in this country about the Palestinian people and the truth about Palestine and Israel. And even in terms of people understanding, what do we mean by occupied territory? So I was wondering if you could, you know, briefly give people a capsulized understanding of why are these Palestinian places referred to as occupied territories?
That's actually a great question. And there are, in fact, two different kinds of occupations that are at stake. The first, the most obvious, and the one that's conventionally used in the West in particular, refers to the occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, which fell to Israel in 1967, during the 1967 war. And that, when people refer to the occupied territories, they almost always mean Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem. Of course, the Syrian Golan Heights also fell in the same war, and the Egypt-Sinai Peninsula at the same time. I think those are separate issues because those were never part of Palestine. So if we're talking about Palestinian territories occupied in 1967, we mean Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. But the interesting thing about Gaza in particular is that, in fact, almost everybody, well, 80% of the population of Gaza, consists of refugees or the descendants of refugees who were expelled from the rest of southwestern Palestine in 1948, when most of Palestine was turned into a Jewish state, the Jewish State of Israel. So when the Zionist project to create a Jewish state in what had been an overwhelmingly non-Jewish land was actualized in 1948, there would have been too many non-Jews in the space controlled by the Jewish state for it to be, you know, seriously call itself a Jewish state, and they were basically removed. And that's what happened in 1948. So, in a way, there's another occupation, which is the occupation of most of the rest of Palestine that took place in 1948. So, to make a very long story very short, about 80% of Palestine was taken over and turned into the Jewish State of Israel in 1948, and then the remainder of Palestine, the remaining 20% or so, fell to Israel in 1967 in the form of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which were basically the leftovers of what had been Palestine. So what we have now is, if you look at all of what had been Palestine, it's under the control of one state, the State of Israel, even though, in fact, Israel doesn't include the residents of what we call the occupied territories as citizens. They're still under its control, clearly, and they have been for 41 years. But in the overall territory, there are roughly equal populations of Jews and Palestinians. It's just that Jews have rights and Palestinians don't, or they have different kinds of rights. And that's what's really at issue, I think, in this whole conflict.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, and we'll revisit that in a minute, but I want to, you know, one of the things I wanted to also sort of make clear to people is that when you were talking about 1948, and I mean, just to reemphasize to people, Palestine at that time, 93% of the people were Palestinian Arabs.
Well, 1948, it was more like two-thirds rather mm-hmm. than 93%. When the Zionist movement, which was a European movement, that's very important to emphasize that, mm-hmm. when the Zionist movement declared its intention to create a Jewish state and it got the support of the British Empire to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine or a state in Palestine in the early 20th century, at that point, you're right, the Jewish population of Palestine was only about 7% of the overall. So they wanted to take a country that had a 7% Jewish population and turn it into a Jewish country, which obviously requires either, you know, extreme imagination or great persuasive power or violence, ultimately. And obviously it's the latter that the Israelis fell to realize their state. The other thing that's important to emphasize is that, as I said, this is a European project, so the Jewish population of Palestine that had been there before the Zionist movement set its sights on Palestine was Palestinian. It was as much Palestinian and as much Arab, by the way, as
Palestine's Muslim and Christian population. So it wasn't the idea to transform this land into an exclusively Jewish state is expressly a European project, and it has to be seen in the context of the climax of European colonialism at the end of the 19th century, which is when modern Zionism was born. So
right.
All these contexts are in play.
Yeah, and it's extremely important because I do think people too often that the mythology and so much is tied up with the horror of the Holocaust, and the mythology that gets promoted is that somehow Israel was formed as a response to the Holocaust, and it had nothing to, you know, that was not why Israel was formed. Israel was formed actually, which had a lot more to do with the combination, the sort of getting together, the coincidental thing of the coinciding of the interests of the Zionists and all the stuff they had going, and the interests of the imperialists in that region. And to me, it's very important for people to understand that there was Palestine, there were hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people kicked out who don't have the right to return. You know, that all this thing, and you make a point in your book, or it's either in the book, and maybe in both places, or a recent article you wrote in Counterpunch, that what's happening in Gaza today is actually rooted in what happened in 1948. And I think this is what we've been talking about, an extremely important point.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, if you look at the situation, why are all these people packed into Gaza? Gaza is a tiny territory. It's about a third the size of Los Angeles. And it's one of the most densely populated territories in the world. And you have to ask, why are these people all there? What are they doing? I mean, the economic base of the territory can't really, in the long run, sustain a population of this size. And you have to remember also that Gaza is an extremely young place. Half the people in Gaza are children. So when you think about all the bombing and destruction that's been going on over the past few weeks, and in fact, the systematic starvation of the territory over the past 3 years, half the people who've been bombed and a large proportion of the casualties, a third of the casualties actually, are children, which is just something that everybody has to bear in mind as we talk about Gaza. But yeah, what does it mean that this territory, which has been isolated from the outside world, it's been systematically cut off by Israeli forms of control, has this population that really doesn't belong there. It belongs back home where it came from in the rest of Palestine, and yet they're bottled into this territory. And not only have they been cut off from the outside world now for the past 3 weeks, they've been bombed with weapons like phosphorus and dense inert metal explosives and high explosives and other forms of weaponry that it is unimaginable to think of any other state in the world using against such an entrapped population. I mean, so for example, it's often said Israel has the right to defend itself from these rocket attacks. And people often make the comparison, imagine if there were rockets coming over the border from Tijuana into San Diego, wouldn't we do something? Or from Canada into Seattle or whatever, wouldn't we do something? And of course, what's not said in the analogy is that, you know, the U.S. isn't occupying either Mexico or Canada, so that automatically disqualifies the comparison. A much closer comparison would be the violence unleashed in the IRA bombing campaign inside Britain in the 1970s. And it's worth pointing out, first of all, that the IRA killed way more people in England in the 1970s than have been killed by all the rocket attacks ever fired from Gaza into Israel. And second of all, it is impossible to imagine, and it just didn't happen historically. In any way, it's impossible to imagine the British sealing off Northern Ireland from the outside world, cutting off supplies of food, water, electricity, fuel, and so forth, and then unleashing the Royal Air Force to drop high explosive and phosphorus and cluster bombs and so forth on a trapped population, in densely packed civilian neighborhoods to drop these kinds of weapons. And I think what that raises is then the question of, well, how could this happen? What does it mean that an entrapped, besieged, starving, thirsty, desperate population is being bombed with these kinds of weapons on this kind of scale? And I think people have to think through what their own answers are to that question, that this could happen to an entire civilian population, that the excuses about rocket fire, nobody's justifying firing rockets into Israel, but nevertheless, the excuse doesn't hold water. I mean, the historical comparisons, the closest one, as I said, is the IRA in England, mm-hmm. The reaction is just of a totally different order of magnitude.
Let me break in here for a minute, and remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And I'm talking with Saree Makdisi, the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And we're talking about the occupied territories. We're talking about Gaza, the massacre going on in Gaza right now, even though there's a ceasefire, and there's been many ceasefires before. And we're talking about the nature of the occupation so people can get an understanding of where this comes from. And sorry, one of the points that you make, I think this point that you're getting into is an important point to pursue. You know, one of the things that I had Richard Falk on the show a couple weeks ago, and he made the point that, you know, actually when you look at the response of the Palestinians, that there's actually that he would look at that, and he said this may be, you know, you could look at that, if you wanted to call that a crime, you could look at that and say it's a crime of survival. And, you know, and he, but he also made the point, and you've made the point too, that there's a right when a territory is occupied. I guess you've made this point, that when a territory is occupied, there is the right to resist that occupation. And I want people to understand what, you know, you've done a remarkable job in your book, as I said, of painting what it means to be occupied. This, you know, just the daily life. Can you give people a sense of what it means to be living in the occupied territories in Gaza?
Oh, to live in Gaza means that you are completely cut off from the outside world. And again, the other thing about this is that it's not Israel cutting off Gaza from the outside world has nothing to do with either suicide bombing or rocket attacks, although those are the pretext used most recently. Gaza was systematically cut off from the outside world in 1991 by the Israelis when they imposed the first comprehensive closure. And then it was the closure became sort of institutionalized in 1993. And the first wave of suicide bombings came after that inside Israel, and rocket attacks weren't until 2000. The first lethal rocket attack wasn't until 10 years later, 2004. So this, all this predates the kinds of responses. So what it means, it means that you can't come, you can't go, you can't work, you can't study, you can't visit, you can't do anything unless you have basically Israel's acquiescence in doing so. That's the case in Gaza in an extreme way. It's the case also in the West Bank and also for Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem. And it's the case to a certain, to a less extent, although it's still the case, for Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel itself, Israel within its pre-67 borders. Israel often says that its Palestinian citizens are treated equally. In fact, it doesn't even call them Palestinian citizens, it calls them Israeli Arabs, although they're Palestinian as the people in the West Bank or in Gaza. But inside Israel itself, they too are subject to all kinds of forms of discrimination, like they can't access land because land is held in the name of the Jewish people. If they're not Jewish, they don't have access to it. And there are other kinds of things, that, you know, other basic rights that they're denied. But in the occupied territories, to live under occupation means not to have any control over your own day-to-day life. All aspects of life are ultimately held in check by Israel. To travel, you need a permit. To dig a well, you need a permit. To go to the next town, you need a permit. To get a job, you need a permit. To go to the hospital, you need a permit. Everything you do requires a permit, and the permits only come from the Israeli army. So it's a form of life that is, you know, it's not life. It's really a form of suffocation. Which and obviously it gives right. It produces acts of resistance. Mm-hmm. Not all of them legitimate. I'm sorry to say. Plenty of them are legitimate, but there are obviously acts of resistance that aren't legitimate, like firing rockets at civilians. You're not supposed to do that under any circumstance.
Yeah, but there's a difference between that and actually one of the things that Richard, one of the points that Richard was making, and I think you actually indicate this in your book too, and in particular where you talk about, I'll probably mispronounce the man's name, but Arnon Sofer.
Yeah.
And a really despicable comment he made, because everything you're describing is, and another aspect of the occupied, living in an occupied territory, living under Zionist occupation in Palestine, actually, it's backed up by massive and just horrifying military might that's meant to reduce the Palestinian people to animal, to subhumans. And this is, I mean, that's based on that whole thing. And I keep thinking, Richard made this point about, you know, that the war crimes actually were even, they predate the outbreak of this massacre, that actually the collective punishment, the targeting of civilians, these are all things that have been going on continuously in Gaza and the West Bank.
Yeah, as I said, Gaza was first isolated by the Israelis. Having been occupied in 67, it was first systematically cut off from the outside world by the Israelis in 1991, long before suicide bombing, more than a decade before rockets. And as I said, when it cuts off the territory, half the people that are cut off are children. So what does it mean for Israel to cut off supplies of food and fuel and electricity and water to children, leading, even before this latest round of bombing, to the United Nations documenting, alarmingly documenting, rising malnutrition, skyrocketing rates of anemia in children in particular, and the first signs of actual the beginnings of starvation. What does it mean that an entire population is being deliberately, and you know, going back to that quotation from Arnon Sofer, premeditatively cut off from the supplies of food it needs to survive? This isn't like it's not the first case of famine, clearly, but famine typically happens because of misappropriation or corruption, or the food doesn't get through, or there's some natural disaster. But this is a case of deliberately, premeditatedly reducing an entire population to a subhuman existence. And the words of Israeli planners, Arnon Sofer is one of them. The Israeli government advisor Dov Weisglass joked in 2006 that he wants to put the Palestinian people on what he called a diet. That's a quotation. Again, I mean, they're perfectly explicit in what they're talking about. And then on top of the diet they've been put on, as I said, this encircled population that has no escape. There are no bomb shelters in Gaza for most people, and there's nowhere to escape. The doors are all closed. So you have 1.5 million people, most half of them children, packed into a territory from which there's no escape and in which there's no shelter. And then not only have they been starved for 3 years, they've been subject to 3 weeks of round-the-clock bombardment by these unbelievably devastating weapons like phosphorus, for example. And, you know, again, I think your listeners need to step back, and I'm not going to say for them what's going on. Let everybody, for him or herself, think, what does it mean when you do this to an entire population? And especially given that you're doing it in a way that goes back years and years and years and years, and the people that you're doing it to are people that were removed from the state in 1948, 61 years ago, in order to make room for the creation of a state that has one exclusive ethno-religious identity, as symbolized on its flag, mm-hmm. in which there's no room for all the other forms of ethno-religious identification that had historically prevailed in Palestine. It's important to remember Palestine, historically, for hundreds of years, has been an incredibly diverse and heterogeneous place. All kinds of cultures and religions and ethnicities lived there. And yet...
We're going to have to move to wrap it up, Suri.
Yeah, just turn it into a state with one ethnic and religious identification involves a kind of all these acts of violence that, as I said, pre-exist Hamas, pre-exist rockets, pre-exist all the forms of resistance, legitimate and illegitimate, that have come in response to them. And I think we've reached a point now where, with the viciousness of this last round of bombing, people should see what's going on, and they should see it for what it is, I think. And we need to move now to make sure that this doesn't go on happening, because, you know, the longer we allow it to happen, the more children are going
to
die.
There needs to be massive political resistance. And, Suri, you know, at one point that you made, and we won't be able to talk about it, maybe I'll have you back sometime soon to talk about this other point in your book, but the point about the aim of the Zionists, really, to turn the Palestinian people, their consciousness, and the deepest recesses of their consciousness, to turn them into a defeated people. And to me, you look at that, and you have to look at that also in conjunction with the people who facilitate this kind of atrocity, the U.S., the British, the Russians, the whole quartet that's operating there. And it really does need, the people of the world need to stand up and stop this.
Absolutely, yeah.
Suri, you're speaking tomorrow night at a symposium out at UCLA at the Broad Arts Center. It's 2160 East, the Broad Arts Center at UCLA. It's Wednesday at 5 p.m., and you're going to be joined with Richard Falk, Lisa Hajar, you, Gabriel Peterberg, and you're going to be talking about human rights in Gaza. I really look forward to seeing that. Hopefully I'll see you there, man.
Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Suri.
Thank you.
I'm Michael Slate. This is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. And you want to write to me, you can, at michaelslate@redfuture.com. And don't forget, tomorrow night is the Human Rights in Gaza Symposium out at UCLA, the Broad Arts Center, at 5 p.m. Maybe I'll see you out there. And if not, I'll talk to you again next Tuesday.
They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will